All right, let's start. Last time we left off talking about evaluation measures. So let's briefly recap what we were talking about. Suppose you got a classifier. You're trying to predict whether something is of class C or not. So maybe the class is ham and spam. So you're trying to detect whether an email is spam or not. Your classifier can make two types of mistakes. The false positive mistake is when your classifier thinks something is spam, but it's actually a useful email. The false negative is when your classifier thinks that it's not spam, but it is actually spam. So they are different types of errors, and you can sort of think of them in terms of a confusion matrix, where the errors, the false positives are and false negatives, are the entries of the diagonal. And on the diagonal, you have the true positives, true negatives, and those are the ones that your classifier classified correctly. We talked about several different error measures and accuracy measures that we can build from those basic building blocks, right? So our classification accuracy is just false positives plus false negatives. So that's the total number of errors that we made divided by the number of items that you're trying to classify, right? And accuracy is just one minus error. And we talked about the fact that both accuracy and error are very bad measures if your classes are imbalanced. So they will give you sort of nonsensical numbers. We talked about earthquake predictions here and now, and sort of retrieving web pages on the web. So if you don't use classification error and accuracy, things you can use, you can define false positive rate, which is the same as false alarm rate, which is just the proportion of false positives. The miss rate, also called false negative rate. True positive rate, that's how much of the positive class you were able to classify correctly. And then precision is a funny measure that doesn't, it's not an error measure. It's out of the things that you classified, out of the things that you predicted are positive, how many of those are actually positive examples. And precision is actually a pretty widely used measure. Another thing that I talked about is for these measures, false alarms, misses, recalls, precision, you never report them in isolation. You always report a pair because you can always come up with a system that has a zero false alarm rate, right? Just say no to everything. Or you can easily come up with 100% recall. Just say yes to everything. Right. So you always report them in pairs. That's what makes it useful. Sometimes reporting a pair of numbers is not useful. You want a single number. And this happens in cases. So for example, you're tuning your classifier, right? You're trying to pick the optimal parameters for the future. And for some reason, you don't want to use accuracy. So perhaps your classes are imbalanced. So what do you do in this case? In this case, typically, you either use domain-specific measures, or perhaps you impose costs on the different types of mistakes, right? So your classifier can make false positives and false negatives. So you think about what is the relative cost of one of those errors, right? So if you think about predicting earthquakes, a false positive is you said there's going to be an earthquake, but there isn't, right? So what you have to, a false positive, you said there's going to be an earthquake, but there isn't actually an earthquake. So what you did is you sort of scared lots of people needlessly. So there's going to be some cost associated with that. You know, maybe there was a loss of profits. Some factories weren't running because of your erroneous prediction. So there's a certain cost. For a false negative, there is also a cost, right? So if you predict that there's not going to be an earthquake, but there is an earthquake, then there is a certain cost associated with having an earthquake and not being prepared for it. And that cost is presumably a lot higher than the cost of making a false positive. So if you have those costs, then you can try to come up with sort of an overall cost measure, which is often just a simple linear combination of a false positive rate and a false negative rate weighted by the relative costs of making each type of mistake. So that's commonly used in various event detection domains where you're trying to detect events which are very rare, but you have different costs for sort of missing an event versus saying there's going to be something but nothing happens. Right. So in other fields, you have specific combinations of true positives and false positives. So for example, in web search, one measure that's quite popular is the F measure, and that's just a harmonic mean of recall and precision. So you take one over recall, one over precision, and you take essentially one over that number. Right? So an interesting thing about this type of a combination is it heavily penalizes either recall or precision being particularly low. So it guides you towards a balanced solution. It wants to have approximately the same value for recall and precision. And in different domains, you have different specific utility measures that are used instead of the normal accuracy or misclassification rate. Right? So I guess if you're trying to predict the stock market, then you wouldn't actually use any of these. What you would do is you would have an estimate of gained profit or loss from whatever predictions you made based on whatever. Okay. So that's taking some of these measures and trying to combine them into a single number so that you can tune and figure out which system is the best. But even if you don't combine them, even if you take them as a pair, sometimes looking at a pair of numbers is actually misleading. So suppose you have two systems. You have system A, system B. And for system B, the true positive rate is 100%, the false positive is 60%, right? For system A, true positive rate is only a half, but the false positive rate is 20%. So which is better? Which system do you think it's better? And the problem with this question is that's a very ill-defined question. It's a question that you should never even try to answer. And the reason for that is, despite the fact that they're different, they obviously seem different. They could actually be the same identical system operating at two different thresholds, right? So asking is A better than B is completely meaningless. You're asking is A better than A, right? So now what do I mean? How can you have the same system but two different, two very different looking error rates? And this has to do with the fact that when you're building a classifier, your underlying algorithm, it doesn't just spit out a class, right? It doesn't say yes, no, spam, ham. It doesn't tell you the digit. Usually it does that by computing some sort of a confidence measure. So underneath, it's computing some sort of function f based on your input. And then what it's doing is it's putting that function, it's comparing the value of that function to some kind of a threshold. And if the value exceeds a threshold, your classifier is going to say, yes, it's spam. And if it doesn't exceed, it's going to say, no, it's ham. Right? So we have seen examples of all of them. We just haven't talked about them in this way. Right? So if you're doing naive Bayes, what do you do in naive Bayes? You construct a posterior probability of spam given your observation X, an email. Right? And then what do? You compare this value to a half. If it's bigger than a half, then you say, yes, it's spam. If it's smaller than a half, then it's more likely to be ham. Right? So you're taking the probability, but you're comparing the probability to some sort of a threshold. And the same thing happens with linear classifiers. So logistic regression, linear regression, SVM, all of them learn a weight vector W. Right? And then what happens is this weight vector with a bias term is multiplied by your observation in a dot product. And if the result is positive, then the classifier is going to say it's spam. And if the result is negative, then it's going to say it's ham. So that's the decision boundary, right? So, and the fact that logistic puts it through a squashing function and SVM has a different squashing function doesn't really matter. If the dot product is positive, then it's a yes. If it's negative, it's a no. So you're still comparing it to some threshold. In this case, the threshold just happens to be a zero, right? And if you think hard, just about any classifier that we did actually has a threshold embedded in them, right? So in decision trees, you're at the leaf node, you're looking at the proportion of positives to negatives. And usually, if this proportion is, you know, if there's more positives, even if it's just one out of 100, you're going to say it's positive. Otherwise, you're going to say it's negative. In nearest neighbors, if you're doing, I don't know, 7 nearest neighbors, then you would say if 4 neighbors are positive, then it's positive. If only 3 or less, then it's not. So all of them have this threshold, and this threshold is part of a model, and it's sort of fixed by the model, but it doesn't have to be, right? So what you can do is you can actually compute the posterior to any number between 0 and 1. If you compute it to 0.5, that tends, what that will do is that will give you the optimal error rate. It will give you the highest accuracy. But if your goal is not accuracy, then why would you compare to 0.5? Right. 0.5 is optimal if you're trying to minimize the misclassification rate. Just like 0 in an SVM is optimal if you're trying to optimize a misclassification rate. It's not optimal if you're trying to optimize some other measure, right? it's actually interesting to think about this in relation to the errors that we defined, right? So this threshold T, that determines whether your classifier says whether something is positive or negative. So you can think of the false positive and the true positive and the false negative rates in terms of these thresholds, right? So a false positive rate, when does this happen? This happens when the value of the function exceeds the threshold, but the item was really negative. So we're trying to predict spam. The item is really ham. What are the chances that the function, the confidence function, exceeds the threshold, right? And the true positive rate is similarly, what are the chances that it exceeds the threshold given that it's the class that you're predicting, right? It's the spam. So the big idea here is you don't have to take the default threshold that your system gives you. These confidence numbers are actually useful, and you could put a threshold in a different place, right? So how do you decide where to put the threshold, and where are good places to put a threshold? Those are difficult questions, but there is a way to look at all the thresholds at once, right? So that's something called an ROC curve. So it's a graphical representation of what happens if you try all sorts of different thresholds in your system. So here's a good way to think about this. Suppose I have 15 items that I'm trying to classify into ham or spam, and I'm plotting them sort of as points on the x-axis. And this x-axis, this is my confidence function f, right? So the higher the confidence, think of that in terms of the naive Bayes confidence, right? So you have a 0 here and a 1 here. So presumably, the higher to the right you are, the more confident your classifier is that the item is spam, right? So in naive Bayes, it's directly probability. You can think of it in an SVM. So this number tells you how far away from a boundary you are. And the assumption is, you know, the further away from the boundary, the more confident the classifier would be that that you are of the spam class. I guess it's very obvious in the logistic. It's a little bit less obvious with an SVM. Now each one of these items, this is just an email, and say that the gray ones are the ham emails and the green ones are the spam emails. So depending on where I put a threshold, I will get different false positive and false negative errors, right? If I happen to put the threshold here, right? So what does that mean? That means that all the items to the right of that, my classifier would say, yes, they're spam. Everything to the left, my classifier would say, no, they're ham. Right? In both cases, it would make some mistakes. So these gray items that are to the right, these are my false positives. They're really ham emails, but my classifier calls them spam. The green items on the left are the false negatives. These are the ones that my classifier says are negative, but in fact they are they're spam. So both of them are types of mistakes. And if I compute the true positive and the false positive rate, I get the numbers that I had for system A on the previous slide. So the true positive rate is 50%. I got half of the items correctly. And the false positive rate is 3 out of 15. If I take a different threshold value, I'm going to get a different pair of numbers. Right? So if I place a threshold here, my true positive rate is 100%. I have classified all of the spam emails are on the right side of a threshold. They exceed the threshold. But I also have lots of false positives. So now my false positive rate is 60%, 9 out of 15 items. Right? So what an ROC curve is a graph of the false positive rate versus the true positive rate as you slide the threshold from positive infinity to negative infinity. Right? So imagine the threshold is positive infinity. So I'm right here. Right? At this point, my true positive rate is 0, right? Because I don't classify anything as positive. And my false positive rate is 0 as well, because I say that everything is negative. At this end, both the true positive rate and the false positive rate would be 100%, because I classify everything as positive, both the mistakes and the correct things. But as I slide a threshold along this ranking, what I'll get is I'll get a curve that looks sort of like this. Right? So I have a false positive rate on one axis, true positive rate on the y-axis, and every point in here is a result of sliding a threshold a little bit, right? So when a threshold is at positive infinity, I get this point. When it's at negative infinity, I get that point over there. Right. So with an ROC curve, they're sort of nice because you can immediately make some sort of observations. You can immediately say how close your system is to random performance, regardless of the threshold setting. So I guess the first thing is, what is the perfect performance? A system that has perfect performance would sort of have all of the spam emails up with high confidences, all of the ham emails with low confidences, and there would be a boundary that perfectly separates them all, right? So if you tried to plot an ROC curve, it would look like that, right? So you're starting here. And for a while, as I'm moving the threshold up, I'm just getting the positives. I'm just getting the spam emails. Right? So my true positive rate goes up, but my false positive rate doesn't increase because I'm only getting the positives. Right? Once I hit that point over there, once I get 100% recall, 100% true positive, I start getting the negatives, right? Because there's no more positives. But I keep sliding my threshold. So you get this part of the curve where your false positive increases, but your true positive is already at 100%. So that's what perfect performance looks like on an ROC curve. You can't do better than that. Completely random performance is just a diagonal line, right? And you're thinking, well, why is that the case? So it's useful to think about this. Suppose there is the same number of positives and negatives. Suppose the classes are balanced, right? So there's 10 positives, 10 negatives. Now, what would a truly random system do? It would mix them up sort of uniformly. You wouldn't expect positive confidences to happen more frequently for spam emails than for ham emails. So you expect a uniform mixture of hams and spams over the entire range. So as you start sliding a threshold, what you'll get is you'll get a ham email and then a spam email and then a ham email and then a spam email. So for every increase in the true positive rate, you'll get a similar increase in the false positive rate. So it won't be a straight line like that. What it really looks like is it looks like a little sort of stepping line. And sometimes it'll deviate a little bit from the diagonal. But overall, if you have lots of data points, it's going to follow the diagonal pretty nicely. So if you plot an ROC curve and it follows the diagonal, then you know that your system is actually no better than random. Right. And the argument that I did is based on sort of equal priors when the classes are the same size. But because you're plotting the false positive rates and the true positive rates, The same argument actually holds for imbalanced classes. So it doesn't matter how many spans versus how many hands you have. A random system is still going to produce a diagonal line, because you're not talking about sort of one spam email, you're talking about sort of a fraction of a percent, right? How much do I have to shift a threshold to get another 1% of ham emails versus 1% of spam emails? And for a truly random system, the percentage would be the same for a given shift in the threshold. Okay, so that's the best possible performance, the random performance. The performance of our two systems are actually just two points on one line. Right. So here's my system A, that's the system with this threshold, and this is the system B with the threshold T2, right? Same system, two different thresholds, two different miss false alarm pairs, but the same, but they're lying on the same curve. So that's why it's very useful to draw ROC curves. They allow you to determine if there is indeed a difference between the two systems, or if you are just if you just happen to be running with two different thresholds. I guess what else do you use them for? If you have several systems, you plot an ROC curve for each system, and then you look for cases where one curve completely dominates another curve. So in this case, you would say that the system that produced observations A and B is clearly better than the system that produced observation C. So you can use this as another way to compare whether one system is better than another across all possible threshold values. Another place where this is used is the area under the ROC curve is an alternative to an accuracy measure. So that is, if you compute the area under this curve, the area for a perfect system would be 1, right? The area for a completely random system would be 1/2, and in general, the higher, the better. So you can use the area under the curve as an alternative to an accuracy measure if you need a single number to compare two systems. I guess another interesting thing about ROC curves is they come in nicely when you talk about system combination. So suppose you have two systems. I have system A, system B, and system A happens to be better in the high precision region, so where the thresholds are high, and system B happens to be better at a high recall, right? So its ROC curve is higher in there. Now, suppose I build a very silly system C, which works as follows. It takes a P coin, it flips a coin, and depending on whether it's head or a tail, it either runs system A or system B on the current input. Right? So my input is X, so I either compute A of X or B of X. Right? Now let's see how that system, how a system like this would actually perform. So suppose that the item X was really positive. So maybe it's really a spam email. So what is the probability that we would give a correct response in this case? Right. So we either run system A or system B. Now suppose the coin came up heads, so that's with probability P. I'm going to run system A, and the system A is either going to be above its threshold or below its threshold. And I'm assuming that I'm running A at a particular threshold, right? A threshold like that. A threshold that gives this false positive rate and this false negative rate. So the item is positive, so I have a certain probability that system A, its confidence, would exceed its own internal threshold. And I have a name for this expression. This is just the true positive rate of A. Right? So this is what happens if the coin comes up heads. If the coin comes up tails, I run system B, and system B gives a correct result if it's over the threshold, and that is just the true positive rate of A at the given threshold. So overall, the true positive rate, the probability that I'm correct, given that I'm positive, that's the true positive rate. The true positive rate for system C is just the linear interpolation between the true positives of A and the true positives of B. And P just acts like a weight between them, right? So it's, if it's half and half, I'm just adding them and dividing by 2. So that's for the true positive rate. You can make the same exact argument for the what is it, for the false positive rate, so that's x is really negative, and the probability that I'm making a mistake is the probability that I'm exceeding a threshold, but the item is negative this time. So I get a similar, I get the same expression for the false positive rate. And this gives an interesting result. What is the result? The result is that the point at which point C operates is on a line between the two points where system A and system B operates, right? So if P is 1/2, then this is going to be performance of system C. Its false positive rate is going to be halfway between the false positive of A and a false positive of B, and its true positive, it's going to be halfway between the true positive of A and a true positive of B. And as I make P bigger or smaller, between 0 and 1, I can get any value on this curve. And what is powerful about this idea is any point on this segment of a line is better than either system A or system B. Right? So I could not get this performance if I just ran system A, and I could not get this performance if I run system B. But if I run both of them and combine them in a really, really dumb way, then I can get performance that is better than either system. Okay? So it's a contrived example. It only works when, so you know, this argument works when you have one system that operates better at high thresholds, another system that operates better at low thresholds. But it turns out that the implication is actually pretty powerful. By combining systems, now systems have to be reasonably independent of each other, but by combining systems, you often end up with performance that is better than any one of the components, right? So if you just run an SVM and you optimize it to no end, right? Sometimes you can get better performance by taking that super optimized SVM and combining it with another system that perhaps does a little bit better in some other threshold range, right? It seems a little counterintuitive. It does hold in practice. I think the best example of this was how many of you heard about the Netflix challenge, right? So quite a few. So the winning entry on the Netflix, and actually it's not even the winning entry that's the most interesting. It's the second best, the guys who almost won. If you looked at what they did, their submission was a combination of over 100 different classifiers, right? It was an ensemble system. So they didn't build one super optimized support vector machine. No. They had 100 completely different teams, approaches, and they were combined in a fairly straightforward way. So it's a powerful idea. You can go really a long way by combining lots of things. All right. So we talked about classification. Now let's talk a bit about regression. So in classification, you're trying to measure how often do you give the correct answer. In regression, the question you're trying to answer is, when I'm wrong, how wrong am I? Am I wrong by a few percentage points, or am I wrong by an order of magnitude when I'm predicting something? And you do this because in regression, you're predicting numbers. You're not predicting yes, no. You're not predicting ham spam. You're predicting real numbers. So what you do for evaluating regression is you come up with error measures that try to measure sort of the magnitude of how far off you are from where you should be. So probably the most common error measure is the mean squared error. So that's what you have right here. It's the sum over all the instances that you have in your data, and you are summing up the squared difference between the true value, that's yi, that's what you should have predicted, minus the f of xi, that's your prediction. That's your classifier's best guess for what the y should be given the x. Yeah, and you just take the difference of them, square it up. There's a couple of versions, so you either do or don't divide by n, and you either do or don't take the square root. It doesn't really matter. Different variants are used in different places. I guess it's It's a popular function. It's quite well understood. It's nice in terms of optimization because it gives a parabola in parameter space, and we know how to optimize parabolas quite well. One downside is it is very sensitive to single outliers. So if you have one point for which your prediction was really off, that is going to have a very significant impact on the mean squared error, and that will probably skew your results. What Weka is using for evaluating regression is the relative squared error. That's just the mean squared error, only you are dividing by this factor at the bottom. And what this factor is, it's the mean squared error, but not between your classifier and the truth. It's the mean squared error between the truth and the mean. Right. So what this is saying, suppose I take a very simple regression system which always predicts the mean. Right. That would be the error rate of that system. And by computing the relative squared error, you are essentially saying, how much better is my system than just using the mean for predictions? Right. So if you get a number that's smaller than one, then you know that you've got a really crappy regression system because you're doing worse than if you had just taken the mean of the training data. Mean absolute error, it's similar to mean squared error. The only difference is you're taking the absolute value of the difference between the true and the predicted, right? So not the square. What this does is this makes the whole measure less sensitive to outliers. If you have a single big error, it doesn't do quite as much damage as it would do in the mean squared error, because you're not squaring that number. Another measure that's commonly used for evaluating regression is the correlation coefficient, right? So you have your predictions f of xi. They have a certain mean mu of f. You have the true values yi, and they have the mean mu of y. And what you're doing now is you're taking the deviation of your value from the mean and the deviation of the true value from their mean, and you're trying to see if there's a correlation, right? So at the top, you have a covariance, and at the bottom, you have a product of two standard deviations, one for your system and one for the truth. So where do you use a correlation coefficient? If you take this formula and just mess around with it a little bit. You can rewrite it in the following form. What it is it's a dot product between two vectors where one vector is your system minus your mean divided by your standard deviation times the truth minus the mean of the truth divided by the standard deviation of the truth. So what it's doing, in a way, what the correlation coefficient is doing is it's subtracting the mean from your system and from the truth. It's normalizing them individually by their standard deviations, and then it's comparing the results. Now, why would you want to do this? You want to do this if the scale of predictions doesn't really matter in your system. So one very annoying thing about the mean squared error is you really have to work hard to get the same exact mean. You don't have to work hard, but a lot of the methods out of the box will not have the same mean as the truth, the yi. And if the means are different, then that adds a very significant error component to everything. So if you just want to focus on finding the relationship between what you're predicting and the true value, then the correlation coefficient is always often a good alternative because you're saying I don't really care about the scale. I just want to make sure that I'm predicting numbers in the right direction. That's what it allows you to do. Okay, so that was all supervised methods. For unsupervised methods, evaluation is generally really, really difficult. So the broad goal, if you're trying to evaluate a clustering system or a PCA system, is you're asking, well, I ran it on the data set. Did I capture the structure that's in the data? And that question is really hard to answer. So if you're doing dimensionality reduction, you could sort of look at the likelihood, or you could look at the distance between the points sort of in the original space and then the projected space, and the smaller that distance, the better, or the greater the likelihood for your data, the better. But it's in general, there isn't, I wouldn't say that there is a metric that's used universally for all dimensional error reduction methods. For mixture models, they're typically evaluated in terms of likelihood. What probability does your model assign to the training data or perhaps to a held out data set? And it's sort of hard to say. Likelihood is, I tend to think of it as more of an objective function rather than a good way to evaluate the results of what you produced. And it's actually similar to clustering. The best way to evaluate these is you could either try matching the output of an unsupervised technique to some known labels that you have. An example would be clustering digits and then seeing how they map to the true class labels of the digits. And there you would actually compute your normal accuracy measure or look at the confusion matrix. You can do something like that. If that is not possible, then the best way to evaluate an unsupervised technique is to see whether it helps you do something else. So you run the clustering and then you see, does that make my classification performance better or worse if I include the cluster numbers as features? All right, so that's all on evaluation. And now I'll briefly talk about a topic that we left out. So this is hierarchical clustering. Remember when we talked about when we were talking about k-means clustering? So one of the annoying issues there was selecting k. So what number of clusters should I have in my data? And the annoying thing is there isn't a good way to pick the number of clusters in your data. You basically pull it out of the hat, or you use one of these hacks or heuristics to say how many clusters you have. So the alternative in hierarchical clustering is instead of saying I want that many clusters, you say I want a hierarchy. So I'm going to build an entire tree where at the root all of the data points are going to be in one big cluster, and at the leaves each data point is going to be in its own little cluster, and I'm going to have an entire hierarchy in the middle. What this hierarchy allows me to do is it allows me to abstract myself from the decision of what scale am I operating on, right? So think of the animal kingdom. Are you trying to predict specific, are you trying to predict sort of general classes, or are you trying to predict very specific subtypes of animals? That's what constructing a hierarchy does for you. You get away from this decision of saying, do I want 5 clusters or 20 clusters? You build all possible clusterings, and then you look at the entire tree and see if that makes sense. So there is in general two strategies for hierarchical clusterings, top down and bottom up, and we are going to look at both of them very quickly. So a top down approach, something that you could do is hierarchical k-means. Right? So this is very simple. You take your data set, you pick k, you can just say k equal to 2 if you want to. You run k-means on this data set, that produces 2 clusters, and now what you do is inside each one of the clusters you run k-means again. So what that will do is it'll take a data set, partition it into 2 clusters somewhat arbitrarily, and then you take each one of those clusters as its own data set and then do k-means again. Right? So it'll find 2 clusters in this part and then also 2 clusters in that part. And you keep doing that recursively. Right. So what that produces is that produces a nesting. That produces clusters nested inside other clusters. It's a fast method. The runtime is the same as k-means multiplied by the depth of the tree. And the depth is just going to be the log, the base k log of the number of items. So it's not going to be very expensive. However, it's a greedy algorithm. So once you have partitioned the space into 2 clusters, you cannot undo the partitioning. So for example, if you want to get 3 clusters, then ideally this should be 1 cluster. But that'll never happen because the 3 red points are part of 1 cluster, the 3 yellow points are part of another cluster, and you're just going to keep splitting them recursively. So with this, just like with k-means, you're not guaranteed that nearby points are going to end up in the same cluster. Agglomerative clustering is a way to do exactly that. It's a way to guarantee, depending on how you pick the distance measure, agglomerative clustering guarantees that nearby points will end up in the same cluster. It works in a different way. So hierarchical k-means is a top-down technique. You start with the data, you split it, and then you keep splitting the subsets. Agglomerative works bottom-up. So you start with a collection of singletons. Each point is in its own little cluster. So I have as many little clusters, ci, as I have data points. And then what the algorithm does is it repeats the following iteratively. It finds a pair of clusters that's as close to each other as possible. Right? So you're going to compute, you're going to impose some sort of a distance metric d that takes two clusters and tells you how similar they are, how far away they are from each other. Right? And you're going to pick a pair of clusters that are the closest. You're going to take those two clusters, you're going to merge them into one, so you get ci plus j, and then you add this new cluster to your collection and remove the two original clusters that you merged from that collection, and then repeat. Okay. So so what you're doing is at each iteration of this algorithm, you're joining two things, and that becomes your new sort of node, your new cluster. And at the next iteration, maybe you will join that with something else. So the result of this is you're producing a tree. In this particular case, the tree is called a dendrogram. It's a hierarchical tree of clusters. It's similar to what hierarchical k-means produces, but it has very different properties. One thing that you have to do is you have to define a distance metric over clusters. This is not distance over points. This is a distance between two different clusters. And I'll talk about a few ways of doing that. It is a slow algorithm compared to k-means. So the complexity is at least cubic. So cubic is sort of the best way you can implement it. And the way to see why this is cubic is this is the cost of constructing a point-to-point distance matrix, right? So you're going to have n squared items and d operations for each distance comparison. And then the algorithm itself runs over that distance matrix. And it's going to have approximately n squared, it's going to have n iterations, because at each point you're taking two things and you're merging them into one cluster. And it turns out that for each one of those iterations, you're going to end up updating quite a bit of that similarity matrix. So let's look at an example of this running. So suppose that this is my set of data points, and I'm just going to use Euclidean distance as a measure of distance between the two points. So each one of these points is a cluster of its own. So what I look for is I look for the two nearest clusters. And it looks like in this case, the points A and B, or the clusters containing the points A and B, are the closest to each other. So what I would do is I would put a link between A and B, and that joins the two nodes A and B in the dendrogram. Right. So now I remove A and B individually, and I put a cluster AB into my collection. And I repeat the whole procedure. So next thing, I measure all the distances again. Maybe the points J and K are closest. So I put a link between them and put a link between them in the dendrogram. I keep doing that, so I get C and D next. Now, so this is the point where I'm joining two clusters. So the points B and D are closest to each other out of everything that's left. So putting a link between them, that corresponds to taking cluster AB, that cluster, and cluster CD, and merging them into one. I'm actually going to take questions at the end. So I'm joining two clusters into one right there. You keep going, putting the links between points that are not connected, that are closest to each other. And at the end, you will end up with one big tree that contains all of the nodes, right? So you keep doing that until everything is connected. And at this point, you are at the root of the tree. So you can just take this tree and do whatever you would do with it, do whatever you would want to do with a hierarchy, right? So this is your ontology. This is a hierarchy of data that you have created. So what does this hierarchy tell you? It tells you that there are two big groupings in your data, HIJ, KMM, and then ABCDEFG. Those are the two big groupings, but those two groupings can be subdivided further, right? So maybe, you know, again, if you're doing the plant analogy, maybe these are plants, and maybe these are animals, and then within the plants you have certain species and subspecies, and then within the animals you have species and subspecies. I don't know anything about biology, so. but that's an idea. You arrange your data as a tree, and then you try to use it in the way that you would want to use a tree. If you want to have a fixed number of clusters, like in k-means, so suppose you look at this tree and you say, well, I still want to have my six clusters or however many, what you can do is you can put a threshold on the distance or on the number of clusters, right? So the distance between the clusters that grows as you go further and further up the tree, right? So if I put a certain threshold in the distance, I'm saying I'm not going to join things if they're more than a certain distance apart from each other, that gives you a set of clusters, right? So if I put a threshold here, this would be my one cluster, A, B, C, D, E, right? That's the cluster. Then I have a cluster F by itself, I have a cluster G by itself. I'm just looking at the lines which are bisected by the threshold line. And then I have another big cluster, which is H, I, J, K, M, N, right? And then I have L on its own. So you can use it to get a tree. You can also use it to get a flat set of clusters. The big thing that you have to do is you have to define how you're measuring distances between these clusters. And the point here is that you want to measure distance between the clusters to run this algorithm, not between individual elements. Distance between elements is obvious. We've discussed that already, right? You take Euclidean distance or any one of the alternatives that we talked about. But how do you go from a distance between points to a distance between clusters? And there is lots of different ways to formulate it. And depending on how you formulate it, you end up with very different clusterings. So the simplest thing to do, suppose I have these two clusters, the red and the yellow, how can I measure distance? The simplest thing is you look for the two points that are closest to each other, right? So you say, well, this red point is very close to this yellow point, so I'm going to take that as the distance between the red cluster and the yellow cluster. So that is known as single link clustering. Mathematically, you're taking the minimum over all the pairs where one point is in this cluster, another point, one point is red, another point is yellow, and you're taking the minimum of all the distances between them. So that's single link. This is what I used in the previous slide to group things into a tree. It does have certain downsides. So what single link does is it tends to produce this stringy configuration where A is like B and B is like C and C is like D, and pretty soon you have A in the same cluster as Z, right? Just because of all the intermediate links. This is sometimes undesirable. An alternative is complete link. So complete link does the completely opposite thing. You have a red cluster, you have a yellow cluster, and I'm looking for two points that are as far away as possible within the two clusters, and I'm taking that to be the distance between the two clusters. Right. So this will produce very different types of clusters. This tends to impose sort of a limit on the radius of any cluster. So if single link produces little chains, very long chains, then what complete link will do is it'll first join all the individual, all the singletons into pairs. And then it will start joining pairs together, but it'll be very conservative. So it'll try to, it'll avoid these strings, the stringy configurations. Something which sits in the middle between single link and complete link is average link. So here, instead of taking the minimum or the maximum, what I'm doing is I'm taking the average of all the distances. it's sort of a nice middle ground between the two approaches, and it's one property of average link is it's less affected by outliers, which do affect complete link quite a bit. What are other ways you can do it? The centroid. So if you have two clusters, you compute the central point of one cluster, compute the central point of another, and then just measure the distance between the centroids. One particularly effective method is Ward's method. So what this is doing is this is adding, this is using the objective function of the k-means inside of agglomerative clustering. So what it's doing is it's saying, I had two clusters. Suppose I merge them and I end up with one cluster. What is the deviation between the centroid of that cluster and all of the newly merged points? So if you think about it, this is the same expression that we had when we talked about what does k-means optimize. K-means tries to optimize that quantity between the centroid and all the points around it. So this is in fact optimizing the same criterion, but in a very different algorithm, in an algorithm that produces a tree rather than a flat hierarchy. So these are very different methods. They lead to very different clusterings of the data. All of them, actually, except for this one, I'm not sure about the centroids, but all of them can be implemented based on a simple distance matrix. So if you compute the point-to-point distance matrix within your data, then all of these algorithms, except the centroid, have an efficient implementation in terms of the distance. And the computational complexity is the same for them. So doing average link, it looks like there's lots of points, but it's actually the same amount of computation that you're doing here. All right, so that's all for clustering. And I guess that we talked about three big things. So we talked about k-means, which is a fast iterative algorithm that you need to run multiple times. We talked about mixture models. It's a probabilistic version of k-means. And today we talked about hierarchical clustering. So that's basically a way to get away from the question of how many clusters do I have, and instead to produce a tree that has all possible clusterings of your data. All right, I guess I'll stop here. And any questions? OK, so don't forget, the deadline for the coursework is tomorrow, 4 p.m.
I didn't think you'd get through that.
I didn't think I did.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of things we have to get together. One of them, the one I didn't write down, which is the one I just thought of, is the we're going to hand out course evaluations.
Oh, yeah. Do you want to do them? So last time you did the...
Yeah, but that wasn't so good. I think it'd be better if we came to do something online. Because we got a better response rate than I would have thought, but I think it was like 20 out of 120 or something like that, which is a lot better than I was expecting, but it's still... May I ask if this is the last week of lectures?
This is the last week, so Thursday will be the last lecture.
Okay. One thing about the slide that showed the rock curve. Mentioned that t was ranging from minus infinite to positive infinite. As you explained, it's the other way around, right? It takes a t varying from positive infinity to minus infinity. For the rock.
Which direction you go doesn't really matter.
No, just for the graphic. Doesn't it matter?
So this would be the positive infinity.
Yeah, right.
And this would be the negative. Did I say it the wrong way?
No, you said it the right way.
Just this.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know if you want, yeah. You aimed at putting it in the different order.
Yeah, this is confusing.